I'd like to welcome everyone to the study session for May City Council, Thursday, May, what is it today? May 5th, the Cinco de Mayo. I heard a really bad joke on the way in, and I'm not going to even repeat it, it's so corny.
Thank you.
What?
Claude makes me laugh.
The threat, huh? First item on the agenda today is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction, all three of them, on the 11-12 utility rate adjustments. Ms. Candace? You looking around for some support?
I am.
I don't blame you.
Catherine will be joining me shortly.
Hi, sorry.
That's okay.
Well, it's about time, Ms. Sorensen.
Yes.
Excuse
Good
me,
morning.
Doctor.
I apologize, Dr. Sorensen, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Good morning.
The good doctor has arrived.
Yes.
She has. So now we can commence. Good morning.
You can start, too.
Exactly. Good morning, Mayor and Council. This morning, what we'd like to do, we'll begin to get ready to start. We're going to review with you today what we have reviewed with you previously at some audit and finance committees as well as at a previous council study session. And what we'd like to do is go over our utility rate recommendations for the 11-12 fiscal year. just a summary, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. This is just a review of the process that we go through to acquire the utility rate recommendations that we have before you today. Number of water and wastewater accounts are continuing to increase. That's one of the areas that we are looking at in depth this year. This requires us to build and maintain the infrastructure to support them, so those costs continue to go. In the meantime, our consumption in water services has drastically decreased over the last few years, and we've discussed that with you in the past, and we just want to kind of remind you of where we are sitting today. This is a reminder of our vacancy concentration. Excuse me. After our census 2010, if you look at the valley, what you're seeing is that in the Mesa area, we do have a very high level of our high occurrence of vacancies. These are homes that are still active accounts on our books, but they do not have any usage or consumption in our water area. And so what that does is because our bills are based on consumption rather than a standard base charge, that's where we're seeing our reduction in our revenues.
So they're active with no activity?
They are active. They are inactively active. That is
actively
correct.
Actively inactive. Right. Okay. Well, which is it? Are they inactively active or active with, but are inactive?
Active.
Either one.
Either one. We don't receive any revenue from them.
Thank you.
God, this is going to be a long meeting.
This is just a comparison of where we stand in our vacancy rates over the past few years. If you can see our 2010 rates for the Maricopa County in general. And that kind of shows what the economic, our current economic status is having to do with our housing this year. This is really where it comes together. What does this mean to us? The vacancy rates in the valley, as we say, we have active accounts or accounts in our water and wastewater area continue to increase. So we do have some growth out there still. What's happening is our consumption on our average consumption per meter or per account has declined radically. There's many different factors that are going into that. We've discussed that with you previously, but there's many different things besides just consumption. We know that there's just people are conserving. We know that the water use it wisely is working, but that's not what's causing us the problem in our revenues. Our revenues are really the vacant homes that are sitting out there where we have the ability to provide the service. We have to maintain the infrastructure. We have to replace the pipes, but there's no consumption. And because our utility rates are based on consumption, or at least our water and wastewater are based on consumption, that's where you're seeing our dramatic loss in revenues over the last few years. Okay. We had hoped, if you look at this graph in 9-10, between 8-9 and 9-10, we had hoped we had seen kind of a leveling or a bottoming out of the consumption. But if you notice from 9-10 to 10-11, that just didn't happen. The vacancy rates are continuing to increase. The costs, however, do not continue to increase. The costs continue to increase and to provide the services. So this is just a graph of what the cost for the water, to provide the water service to the citizens, the direct cost as well as the debt service and our general fund transfer that's included. And over the time, you can see that those really haven't changed over time. So as we go back and look from 08-09, 9-10, 10-11, our costs are on track of where they should be. And as Catherine has mentioned in previous presentations, they've done everything they can to really streamline and to show that we are actually below the cost of the municipalities in the area. Okay. So the difference is really on the consumption and the revenue side. What do we do from here? Water and wastewater revenues are reliant on the variable component, not on the base component, but our consumption is affecting that. So before you today, we have two options that we've reviewed with you before. One is to continue the variable rate-based model. That means not to do any type of restructure. Just make sure that we're covering our costs with the revenues that we need to get in. Okay? The other one is to implement a minimum water and a wastewater charge, a water minimum based on 3,000 gallons per month, and a wastewater minimum based on the cost of 2,000 gallons per month. This is a comparison of those two options. So the first option you see there is if we continued the way we are today, no minimum water charge or wastewater charge, just continuing our basic structure, the rates that we would need would be a 7.5% increase on water and a 6.5% increase on wastewater. And as we spoke of before, we do those over a multi-year period. So what we're saying is at this point, based on what we know today, we would need a 7.5% increase on the rates for not only 11-12, but 12-13 and 13-14, at least within the next 3 years. If we implement the minimum water charge, we would need a 6.8% increase on our water rates and a 5.8% increase on our wastewater rates, again, over that same three-year time period. That's per year over those 3 years. And this just gives a comparison of what that does, what the effect is on our average water consumer.
Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you, Mayor. The last time we talked about this, you had a 5,000-gallon minimum, right? You lowered it?
We did.
Did you look at...
Wait. I don't think you weren't here for the updated presentation.
I missed right. The last council session, we actually came back with three options. One of the options was the 5,000 minimum. And then the second option was the 3,000.
Well, it's really not a minimum. What we did is we raised the base thing, and you get 3,000 gallons free.
That's correct. Yeah.
It's included.
Right.
And
3,000 gallons is included in your minimum charge.
You know,
yes.
We had quite a few individuals that were concerned with that because they don't use that much. Does the 3,000 make them all happy?
Councilwoman Higgins, I would say for the most part, yeah, that's correct. I've spoken with many constituents over the last few weeks, and, you know, I can't say that anyone at this point that I've spoken with remains unhappy with the current proposal, but I will say that there were one or two people who I just stopped hearing from. Now, whether that was because they were satisfied or because they just decided not to talk to me anymore, I'm not sure. But, yeah, it is very difficult to use less than 3,000 gallons a month, and we're looking at the impact to our core constituents, people who are here year-round, mm-hmm. who would consistently use less than 3,000 gallons a month, is very, very small, less than 2%, and some portion of that also includes those empty houses that are just, you know, at zero. So it's a very, very small number.
Okay.
And again, for those who would be potentially impacted by this and might be on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, we are proposing that we implement an affordability program.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
And I was going to, I just have a question on the, a big part of the problem you've outlined is the foreclosed homes, where the accounts are zero. Who would you bill for the minimum charge?
Right. Well, Councilmember Kavanaugh, it depends. There are some foreclosures where they do not keep the account active at all, and they let the landscaping die, and you've seen some of those more blighted homes. But it's far more common that when that home goes into foreclosure, the bank that owns the property keeps the account active to maintain the landscaping. When they do that, they're you know, likely falling under that 3,000 gallons because there's no one living in the home. So they're paying a very, very small portion towards the cost of the utility. And with this proposal, we're hoping that will change.
Either way, generally when you have a foreclosed home, the usage is very different than when someone's living there.
Absolutely.
So either way, the aberration in the system is that you built the system for months or usually years, there's a certain level of activity. Now that has suddenly dropped off. and whether they keep the account active and use a minimal amount or they cancel the account, either way, we have a model that's based on the fact that if you have a home there, and we have a long history of knowing how many vacancies we would have, and that's built into our projections, and it's built into our rate structure. Well, the foreclosures have created this aberration because now we're off the charts. We've never experienced such a dramatic number of homes that just basically left the system or suddenly reduced the system. That's what I'm hearing from you.
Correct, Mayor.
And that's why what it does is it exposes the and it is a weakness when you have a consumption-based system, mm-hmm. Just like with sales tax. When people quit buying, we quit collecting sales tax. When people quit using water, and we're not talking conservation here. We're talking average, normal use, even if they are conserving. If they suddenly quit using, that's a situation that is not normal. It's abnormal. And our system is not set up to handle that drastic drop in revenue.
That's correct, Mayor.
Okay. That's correct. The cost that we show you on the slide doesn't go away just
right.
Because they're not using the water.
Because we built the system assuming the normal situation, and we don't assume that everyone's going to be using water. We have a normal amount of
forecast the consumption.
You have some vacancies, but that vacancy is in a normal, even in a bad economy, is 1-2% maybe of the dwelling units in your city. Now we're up to, by some estimates,
slide 5, the census says almost 14%.
Oh. Yeah. And so, you know, whether it's 8% or 14%, it's 7 to 10 or more times what we normally experience.
Correct.
And that's a big shock to the system.
And we're still providing services to that household, whether there's somebody living there
right.
or not. So it's not just the services of the water.
Because someone could move in tomorrow.
Public safety yeah. services to that house as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
And that cost doesn't go away either.
Okay, Councilman Richens.
I know last time we had the discussion, so for the benefit of those of you guys that weren't here, really if you go to slide seven contains what your base charge should be. You know, I'm still in favor of seeing your having no minimum water charge and charging for gallon one. So having two separate charges, one is for the base fee of maintaining our infrastructure and the other is for the commodity. And that's really how we're gonna achieve real conservation on the conservation side, when people have to pay directly for the cost of the water they use. But the charge that never goes away, the cost, is maintaining that infrastructure, the pipe to that house. So whether you're a snowbird here for 6 months a year, or you're part-time resident or full-time resident, we still have to make sure the water, when you turn the tap on in your house, water has to come out. And I think that the chart on 7 illustrates what the real base charge for that should be. So we're still subsidizing by doing it this way with a 3,000-gallon minimum charge. You know, and I know that would be hard to swallow for a lot of people, those numbers. I mean, what in this next year it would be $75. That's what it would cost to get water to your house. I mean, we just don't have a real grasp of what the water infrastructure and the cost of water to get to us. And we need to eventually get to that. We need to get to that point, so we can maintain our infrastructure for years to come, and people can actually have the opportunity to do real conservation by, you know, they don't use the water, they don't pay for the water.
Right.
Okay, fine.
Absolutely. And Councilmember Richens, as you, I think, have pointed out, there we're looking for that right balance, and we're hoping that this proposal presents a very reasonable balance of those different factors.
Councilmember Fender.
Thank you. A couple of issues that I've been researching and visiting with staff is, with regard to the foreclosure mess, I hope at a committee level in the coming year that we'll be able to look into talking with the business side of the water department. Had a lot of problems on HUD homes, and what they do is HUD will take the home or be in some form of foreclosure. Then folks that are asked to care for the house, they'll go out and cut our locks, damage the meters, or take water for long periods of time, you know, 6 months to a year until this foreclosure is done. And we have all the expense with that and none of the revenue. So I know that's one aspect we need to look at from the business side. And the other one, again, hopefully at a committee level, is a learning process about on-project and off-project water systems. And I know that's going to be actually probably a politically sensitive nature. And basically, as I understand, maybe you could just quickly describe it so I don't hack it up, but I think that's an issue to be discussed when we talk about the conundrum of conservation versus, you know, the revenue side of the city.
Yeah. Councilmember Funder, yeah. There are some significant differences in our water system on project versus off project. But for the most part, they are both served by surface water treatment plants. Groundwater use is very uncommon in our system. We use it basically for peaking. And I will say that there are some differences in the commodity cost between on and off project, but the bulk of the cost really comes in through the cost of the surface water treatment plants and the cost of the operation of those themselves. That's certainly something that we could continue to explore. For your point towards people, you know, cutting off our locks and getting into the water meter when they shouldn't be, you'll notice that we are ramping up our revenue enforcement program. Hopefully you've seen something in the paper and on Channel 11 about that. That is something we're taking greater notice of and trying to make sure that, you know, for those who are doing things and damaging the system that they shouldn't be, that we're catching them and taking appropriate action.
Go ahead. Okay. Don't let us interrupt you.
What staff is recommending is to implement the minimum charge that would include the first 3,000 gallons of water for that.
So that's what will be in the proposed budget, Mayor and Council. When you get that, we bring that forward. So
right. So that'll be coming through on June 6th is when you'll actually see the ordinances come through for all of our utility rate recommendations. Will be coming through on June 6th for adoption on June 27th.
Is the June 6th is the notice? What is it called?
The notice of intent is actually on May 16th.
Okay.
So on May 16th, you'll be asked to adopt a notice of intent. That does not actually set the rates or recommend the rates. It just sets our public notice that we will be reviewing and adjusting the rates, and it just meets our public notice requirements for the state. So on May 16th, you'll be asked to adopt
that. Number or our
Councilmember Higgins.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
On slide 9, I still have a question.
Okay.
The box on the left that has no minimum water charge.
Correct.
Would cost the average average resident $465 a month?
That's correct.
And bring in the $55.80 annual impact. Oh, to that person.
To them.
To that person.
Got
that
it.
Person. That would be the annual impact to an average customer.
So what to an average customer, but your lower end person who's not, does this meet your needs of the person who's not using water? No, because
it does not.
We all are paying then for the water that someone else isn't using for the infrastructure.
Well,
so this doesn't charge that person.
No, you just have
empty.
You just have to raise everybody's rates
to cover it,
to make up for the loss.
So the box on the right.
Those that use are subsidizing those that don't.
I mean, not just those that don't. Those that like aren't the vacant houses, not the low water.
That's what I mean. Those that don't.
Not the conserver.
No, not the conserver, but the vacant house.
Council, just a reminder: there is a minimum charge today, just for hooking up, $12.
$11 before the.
So that would go up by the.
That would go up
7.5%, but it's still much less than what it would cost.
Right.
So going to the minimum, the 3,000 gallon, now that brings that number up to where those are paying at 3,000.
Well, the idea is that somebody who uses 3,000 gallons today, which what we're saying is that's sort of our baseline. When looking at it, that covers 98 to 99%, whatever the percentage you said, of people who use less than that or accounts that use less than that. By raising that base, their rate will go up either not at all or I guess will go up just a minimal amount.
Right, just like everybody else's.
Mayor, yeah, the way that it works is if you're using above 3,000 gallons or above, which is, like you said, nearly everybody, our average user uses 10,000 gallons.
Right.
And the median is 7.
I'm just trying to...
Right. Their rate increase will be the 6.8% under this proposal.
Based purely on what they use?
Purely, on both the base, which is
right.
Today $12.11, that will go up by 6.8%, and then 6.8%
on what they
use. But
they're already using that water now. If you're using 3,000 gallons or less, what you're doing now is you're paying the $12 plus the cost of using the 3,000 gallons.
Correct.
So right now what we're saying is we're raising that base amount so that everyone pays a certain base amount, and it includes 3,000 gallons. So if you're using 3,000 gallons or less, your overall bill is going to move virtually
not at all.
It'll move a little.
It'll move
a tiny little bit.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Tiny little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, it'll move.
At this point, the comparisons are, just don't make any changes in the structure and just have to increase the rate percentage much higher than we.
Right, you still charge the $12.
So, in fact, even the 3,000-gallon user is going to pay even more.
Right.
At 7.5%.
Right.
By increasing the base, the minimum number that includes the 3,000 gallons, which will be increased by the 6.8%, they're still going to be paying a little bit less.
A little bit. Less. But they're still going to be paying less than they would have if we just went on.
The real comparison was when we were at a different number above 3,000. This has a less, much lesser impact than that would have had. Okay. When we were talking going to 5,000, that would have had a more significant impact on the 3,000-gallon user.
The idea is to balance the conservation efforts because, you know, I mean, we have we have this built-in conflict. And if you, one of the complaints, which I think was a valid complaint on the 5,000, is that then you're getting into places where people who are conserving throw up their arms and say, why?
Yeah.
That 3 to 5,000. And that, you know, you're going to have a natural conflict. Why make it worse? Why really focus on that? At 3,000 gallons, even if you're conserving, you're going to be using 3,000 gallons. So we get out of the conflict of conservation versus use, but what we do is that we're able to capture those people, those inactive accounts that still cost money to maintain every month, and we're having them pay their fair share of the costs without disproportionately affecting those people
who
use.
That's the right word. That's the right way to say it, yes.
Yeah, what it does is it keeps those low users from basically subsidizing the non-users. And it also tries to balance, walks a fine line and tries to balance between the conservation and the disincentive to conserve. When we're at 3,000 gallons, we feel like we've sort of gotten over that. We've escaped that disincentive. Okay.
Mayor, I'm not going to try to improve on what you just said. That was good. Thank you.
Is that bad?
No, it was good. It was great. Yeah.
So any more questions on that? Okay.
Okay.
So why don't you go to slide 10. This is just a follow-up from... Okay. Previous request.
So then, as a follow up to the last time that we reviewed these rates, we have revised the average annual homeowners charges survey to go and look at the actual median home value of each individual municipality and to their property tax rates that they have, and this is our now revised how Mesa stands in comparison to the other municipalities within the area.
And let's. Once again, we found a big difference last time, and these comparisons can never be perfect because I know what we did is we changed, for example, the home value in figuring the property tax.
Yes.
What it also does, though, it assumes that average household income are the same in all cities. Yeah. And I know you can't, if we really wanted to get apples to apples, you'd have to take that in consideration because cities make their budgets based on the projected mix between sales tax collections and what's available for property tax.
Correct.
And there's no doubt that Scottsdale collects more sales taxes than we do because their average household income is higher than ours is. Gilbert's average household income is higher than ours is. So, and this also does not include the rate increases for, what, two or three cities?
Correct. The ones that we have noted there have not taken action on their utility rates for the 11-12 or on their property tax rates for 11-12.
So just so we can say, there's no perfect way to do these comparisons because there are variables that are different, but this is a good sort of...
This is a good benchmark for us to use when we're doing a comparison from year to year, as long as we go through and understand which municipalities have taken action and which ones are still pending action for the upcoming year.
Yeah.
So in this example, Chandler and Phoenix have already taken action for the 11-12 fiscal year, so we want to make sure that we're noting that and that the other municipalities have not. So if any of those were to do increases in either their property tax, primary or secondary, or in any of their utility rates across the board, that would change their where they stand in comparison to Mesa.
And Mayor and Council, based on just what we've seen even in Chandler and Phoenix, the rates that we're even proposing to you is interesting. Everybody's kind of feeling about the same pressure, I think.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
And our rate increase is actually lower than
some of the others. I think Phoenix ended up having to get to the...
Phoenix was 7% on their water, and Chandler did 9.3% increase on their water rates.
So we expect that. You'll see that in these other adjustments in these other cities when they make those decisions also. So I think it'll kind of level out
Yeah, and once again, this isn't a perfect comparison because the actual tax burden to someone living in Gilbert is greater than because their household income is greater.
Right.
So they're going to be paying more in sales tax than that.
But, Mayor, yeah, that's correct. And Chris's point is a good one. This really is a national trend, what you're seeing. As our infrastructure ages and needs to be replaced and we're still coping with growth, those are, you know, Clean Water Act, Drinking Water Act standards, those are all expensive undertakings. And this is something you'll see across the nation as pressure increases on water systems.
And Catherine, one of our largest expenses in our debt service is the Greenfield plant, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we know that Gilbert's a partner in there.
Yes.
So they'll be realizing some of those expenses, just as we are feeling that impact. Remember that debt service schedule we showed you in the utilities, how it's going up? Well, there's a large portion of that, obviously, in a new plant such as Greenfield. And so Gilbert is a partner in that, so we expect they'll be feeling some of that same pressure also. Okay. I think that's all we have on this item.
Anything?
Okay. So we'll, I think, go to the next.
Councilmember Kavanaugh, I think, has a...
Oh, sorry.
Well, I just, I wanted to commend you. I think the proposal's improved from the original one that was briefed. I still have concerns, as you know, over the minimum charge. My philosophy on the utility charges, whether it's sanitation or water or wastewater, is pay for what you use. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of a fundamental philosophy in our country that most people would agree with. And so that's where I still have reservations over the minimum. But I think the arguments are that you've raised are very good, solid public policy arguments for that. So, but I just want to let you know, the proposal's improved. I still have reservations on it, just on more on a philosophical standpoint. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Richens.
Well, I remember when we had the conversation about minimum charges and paying for infrastructure and separating water, you know, based on what you pay for, we talked about heading that way. I mean, this was the first step in setting a rate structure that heads towards not having minimum charges at all, that people pay, get their infrastructure, they pay for that, and they pay for the water when they use it. And I think, I'm hoping that we'll continue to work towards getting to a rate structure that looks more like that, so we can make sure we have dedicated funding to take care of what's underground. And then people can deal with their conservation decisions based on what they use.
Yeah, thank you, Councilmember Richens. At least in my view, this is a first step. You know, we're trying to find that balance. This is a first step. We can continue to explore your ideas, Councilmember Fincher's ideas, Councilmember Kavanaugh's ideas. As time goes on, I'm more than happy to have those conversations and come up with, you know, what we think is reasonable. Absolutely.
Yeah, there is a cost for having it there. It's sort of like, you know, someone who owns a house, mm-hmm. and they go away for 3 months. Well, you still got to pay your mortgage, even though you're not there. You know, let's say you go away for the summer. You're still got to pay your mortgage. You're not using your house, but it's there, and it exists, and you have the right, should you come back, to use it. In a way, that's what we're saying to anyone who has an account. They're hooked up to the system. We've expended an amount. It's there for their use, and there's a basic cost that goes with it being there.
Yes.
And that doesn't matter whether you're using it or not using it. There's still a cost that's there. So good movement toward trying to find that balance, better balance. Okay? Vice Mayor.
And firmly grabbing on and holding the third rail, I think we'd be remiss in not mentioning that when you look at slide 7, the general fund transfer is a major issue. While it doesn't cover the direct and debt service costs, it more than covers the debt service costs, the money we run it. This council didn't invent this system, and certainly the money that comes out of this fund to the general fund pays for other essential services like police and fire, also libraries and parks, but the system, at least it would be paying its debt service if that more of that money were kept in the system for its own operation.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
I'm not running for anything.
Not now. And Candace, you're staying there, I guess?
I get to stay one more time.
Yes. Mr. Odom?
Good morning, Mayor, Council. There's been a lot of discussion this spring over debt issuance, and financial policies related to debt issuance. So we're going to do a little briefing this morning on the financial policies that relate to that and so forth. In 2008, the Council adopted some long-held and practiced financial policies and just formalized it into the resolutions of the city. We have 10 areas of major policy, and item number 4 deals with our debt, and it relates to how we make decisions and operate us financially. Some of the highlights of the debt financial policies: long-term debt will not be issued to fund current operations. We also have some discussions about fire apparatus and things like that. So debt terms will match the useful life of capital projected funds. So capital project funds. So we've talked about how we were paying off fire apparatus before the useful life of those apparatus were used up. We will try to be as consistent in our structured debt from year to year. Now, one of the things that we're trying to overcome is some of the things from the past where we've had structured debt that have some real spikes in it. We'll work with those issues going into the future and to restructure debt and smooth debt as best we can. The city receives authorization to sell bonds from citizens through elections. There are 3 main bonding types available to do capital projects. We have the general obligation bonds. We have utility revenue bonds, and under our current situation, we have highway user revenue bonds, which are an excise tax funded debt instrument.
And Chuck, explain excise tax.
Excise tax is with HERF. It's an income stream that we're guaranteeing against that debt issuance to pay for that debt. So they get the first dollar if we got into a situation of
so we're pledging our sales tax dollars.
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas the general obligation bond, it's full faith and credit.
Yeah, let's be careful. We're not paying it with our...
No, you're pledging it.
We're just using it as backup. I know.
It's a technical difference, but we throw that out, excise tax versus general obligation debt, and I just want to...
I just want to be clear, someone doesn't think we're using our own sales tax to pay that. We're actually, by the markets, you always have to have another source to back up in case. Obviously, all of these funds are coming through from ADOT. To pay for that, we're accelerating it, or our regional dollars.
On the HERF dollars, it's coming through our HERF pool from shared revenues, right?
Okay.
So
So everyone understands that HERF pool, the tax is collected at the state level, which are basically gas tax,
correct?
Yes.
Or the tax,
right?
Correct. And those are collected at the state level. Our citizens pay their gas tax. They go into the state, and then the state divvies those back out to the communities based on a formula.
Correct.
Those are the funds that we're expecting or we're using to pay back these debts, which were used to build highways, which is a good use. So we throw these things around, and I have people ask me all the time, "What's the difference?" So
and that's
just want to make sure we
that is correct.
Get into that.
Now, under the general obligation bonds category, there's 2 types. There's the 20% and 6% limitations, and that's 20% of
that's
your secondary.
That's not the interest rate.
No. No. Of your secondary assessment valuation. So that is the limit any city can issue in that category. Now, rather than
the amount of debt. The limit on the ceiling on the amount of debt cannot exceed 20%
of the secondary assessed valuation.
That's like the second line on your little tax, not your bill, but the first notice you get on your home, which is your notice of valuation.
Correct.
That precedes your tax bill. And it has a full value, and it has a secondary.
And it has a primary, correct.
Primary, yeah, okay.
So rather than read off all the things a 20% bond can pay for, which is most everything, it'll go to the 6%. In the city of Mesa's case, the library would fall under the 6% limitation. Most everything else that we deal with would fall under the 20% limitation.
Now, do you have the numbers in front of you? Because we talk about debt limitations, and there's even been some schedules where we show what various cities are.
We're at about 22% of, we're going to get to that, but it's about 22% of our assessed valuation at this time. And we're in very good stead compared to other cities.
Wait a second.
22% of our limit.
Why don't we reduce that into real terms? Because now you're using two different terms. So 22% of this would be about 5%.
Overall, correct.
Overall. Well, you're using 20% of overall, so let's keep them the same.
Yes.
We're allowed to go up to 20% of our valuation. We're at
5% of total secondary assessed valuation.
So we're one less than 1/4 of what we could do.
Correct.
All right.
Now, utility bonds, they have no statutory limitation, and they're only limited by what your debt covenants are in relation to your ratepayers paying for that debt. And we've talked about the highway user bonds. They're secured by our HERF funds received from the state. and we won't go over that again. Just to go over what we have on our bond authorizations, prior to, I've got the category by the different issuances, and you can review those again. The prior available authorization that we have remaining total between all three types is about $413 million. We're issuing $83.3 million this year, giving us a balance of $330 million approximately. So, now, one of the issues I do want to point out is on, we do have general obligation authority from pre-2008 that we are not, we've made a policy discussion or a decision that we're not going to issue that without council approval, without secondary tax.
Okay, who's we?
That's the collective.
Mayor, this goes back to the issue here is that these bonds were sold, or not sold, they were authorized to vote.
And when we say authorized, these, let's speak English.
There was
voter approved. Bond issued, voters have approved up to, an additional $329 million, but that does not include the pre-2008, or it does include?
It does include.
Okay, and that includes the pre-2008.
We've chosen not to go sell.
Staff has chosen.
The council has chosen.
Us council or the previous councils?
The previous council.
Okay, I want to make
not
sure.
Not to sell these bonds because as we sell these are the bonds that are being paid off out of the general fund. They're being paid, this is being paid from sales tax. Now, because that approval exists, the council, I'm assuming, could choose to levy
a secondary. We could choose to include those
because every bond authorization, every bond issue that's put before voters, the way that we've interpreted it, has the approval to utilize a secondary property tax as a source. It's that councils prior to 2008 chose to not impose a secondary property tax.
The idea is, again, these were approved by voters.
Right.
And we'd have to go back, and I don't even know all the specific years. Are they different years?
Yes, there's different years.
So they're there. We haven't issued the debt. It's just been approved that we could. So I don't want anybody thinking we have anybody out there collecting interest. We're not. It's available for the city, but we've chosen not because of our current financial model that we would back before we had the secondary property tax. The decision was to not sell any additional debt.
Can I synthesize this? In other words, if we as this council choose to authorize the issuance of these bonds, we would have to make the determination whether to impose a secondary property tax or continue it, which would mean they would be paid off with general fund monies. Okay. Councilor Kavanaugh.
And just an additional clarification on that, the council could choose, if it wishes, on the bonds that we have sold for that period of time, the council does have the ability to levy a secondary property tax on the existing general obligation bond debt, the $22 to $25 million that we have.
Correct.
We have the ability to do that at any point in time. Correct. Or if we sell under the prior authorizations, the council has the ability
correct
to do that.
And we are actually doing some of that today.
Yes, we are.
Correct. To fund fire station
219 and 220.
Yes. Correct.
Councilor Fincher.
On the prior authorization bonds, I mean, they go way back. I remember even some in the 80s. Why do we still carry that authorization? Why would we just not, or why would we incur future debt or future bond elections if we're carrying so much authorization from the past?
Well, what I would say is the authorization was given by the voters, so it doesn't sunset by law.
It's a council decision.
It exists. Mm-hmm. So whether you make the policy decision to issue against it or not, that is your policy decision. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't sunset under the law on the authorization,
and we just
because
do it because
voters approved that level of authorization.
Do we reflect on the old authorizations before we take the step to go out for new bond authorizations and say, hey, we've got this back here, and why don't we just utilize that? Or it just seems like it's a compounding bowl of authorization.
Well, we've had the discussion for the 2008, and not this council, but the council had a 2008 discussion. And it was their policy discussion to go forward that they were not going to levy a secondary against the past debt. except for 219 and 220 and some operating costs related to public safety. So it was that. That's what
previous
we're
council
under
didn't
now.
Decide that.
This council.
Well, this council decided that.
Right. And Mayor, Council, one of the things
yes.
we'd have to look
yeah.
at too, we'd have to go back and that we'd have to look at. I think some of these are fairly generic descriptions. I'm assuming stormwater and parks and recreation. We'd have to go look at the public safety previous or libraries. You want to see when they, even when they were voted on and approved, you know, how we kind of provided a list of the types of projects. We'd want to look at that too.
Let's get the meat of the matter is how they're funded. That's really the determining factor here, because bond authorization, even in the descriptions, are broad enough. I'm sure that we could plug those in, except for with maybe some very specific issues. The idea is it, if it's pre 2008 authorization, the idea was it would be paid out of general funds, repaid out of general funds. Post 2008 beyond, it's secondary property tax. So really, our decision is if we issue debt, how we're going to repay it. That's really the major determining factor, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So we could go back and use up that old capacity and decide now that, hey, you know what? The world's changed. We're in a new system now. Before we sell these, we're going to decide that we're going to pay these out of a secondary property tax, or we can just leave those there and say until we get to a time where we want to use general fund again, we're not going to use that authorization.
That is correct.
Those bonds. Okay. I mean, does that synthesize it?
Yeah, it gives any council the flexibility to, based on their current financial situation, how they want to choose to either fund this authorization or to issue additional authorization for a specific issue like secondary.
That really goes back to repayment. Tax. Our decision how to repay.
How you want to repay.
That's really the determining factor. Okay.
And just kind of give you a breakdown, in the GO category, we about have $103.3 million in existing authorization after our 2011 series issuance. So we have about $71.5 million, that's the 2008 authorization, so there's about $32 million pre-2008 authorization left. The next slide, slide 9, you have seen this one before, and this is the 2009, that's the last audited financial statements we could get, so we've used the Department of Revenue source on this. This compares how City of Mesa's outstanding GO debt per resident and in total stacks up on the comparison basis, and you'd asked the question before, the percent of GO debt limit used. That'd be about 5% of our secondary assessed valuation, and it'd be about 22.4% of the limit that we're allowed to set. Just you have seen slide number 10. This is the existing.
Councilmember Higgins has a question.
I'm sorry. Can you just say that again? Because the numbers didn't click. And I'm
okay.
sure there. I
just.
I just
talk
I lost
about
it
our, what's the capacity.
We have.
No, you can. Okay. I mean, you can say it again.
Well, then. He's using different numbers. So go ahead.
Okay.
Thanks.
We have about 78% of our capacity remaining on GO debt.
Okay?
That's the
That's
easiest
it.
Way to remember it.
So that 5% of whatever was some random other
well,
number?
Well, because you gave me, there's a statutory limitation.
Okay. Yeah, the state, okay. State law says how much a city can issue. We've only issued, we've issued less than one quarter of what we could issue under state law, as opposed to Tempe, for example, who has issued two-thirds.
Right.
Of what they could issue based on their assessed valuation.
And so that's why you say 78% remaining.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
The easiest
Council
way, I think, to remember this is
yeah, makes sense.
You have a credit card. You've only used 20% of it. You have not maxed out your credit card.
And we,
right?
Yes, right.
Yeah, if we had a $5,000 credit card, we've used about 1,000 of it. Tempe's used about 3,000 of it.
Yeah. I just kind of fell asleep there for a second. Keep that, you know?
It gets confusing. Councilman Fender, you got it?
Just an observation. You know, with what's going on in the federal debt, and I hear a lot of citizens call back and say, hey, we are just really upset about this. And then when in the past when we've done our 2008 issuance and talk about whatever in the future, we really need the education, because even I was going, wow, the numbers are big when we issue debt, $193 million here, whatever. You know, these numbers are huge for the average citizen. But it is so nice to have this education and this portion that we can take out and go, look, out of all the cities, we are at the very bottom of debt. And in the percentage of what's authorized, we're at the very, you know, the first quarter. So it's an education process. I have to feel it and go through it even with myself. So I'm hoping as we do the education, the outreach in the future, that people can see how well this is handled. This is not the federal government mess that's going on. So anyway, I mean, just want to put
thank you, Councilman. We actually have budgets. We balance our budgets, so that's the difference right there.
Vice Mayor.
And to that point, Alex, too, and I think he's going to get to another slide, you know, the federal government borrows money for its operating expenses, right, and we don't come anywhere close to that.
Do not.
So no, we'll get to that in a little bit.
Okay. Slide 10 is just demonstrating again, getting to that discussion of what we have pre-2008 authorization issuance and we're paying debt service on. That's the dark blue bar, and the light blue is the tax-supported GO debt that's been issued since 2008.
And what's the, unless you have it, that dollar amount is still 20 some odd million.
Yes, 26? About 25 to 27 coming off there.
Okay, 26, I guess. Mm-hmm. So 26 million out of our general fund. So about 8%.
Oh, the current, the total general fund?
General fund's just, what are we round, let's say $300 million, yeah, or let's round it to $300 million.
Well, that would be added on top of, so of the million. Of the liquid dollars, yes.
So $325 million, still about 7%.
20, yeah.
7% or so of our total general fund, or basically our sales tax and revenue sharing goes or is redirected debt by us to debt service. Is there any other city that we know of that pays, of all these numbers, that pays their GO debt obligation out of general? Out of
we're general still looking nationally to see if we can find anybody.
Nationally? Is maybe there, globally, I think there's a city in Chile nationally that does that.
When we did this study in 2008, we could not find another city that
there
operated
was very,
the same.
They didn't have a secondary property tax or a property tax support.
And we're going to get to the comparison between us and other cities. But basically, we are a trailblazer in that.
The trail nobody else has gone on. Yeah.
Nobody's following us, but we have this nice trail.
We blazed the trail and no one else has taken it.
And for being a person responsible,
we've been leaving breadcrumbs and the birds have been picking it. There's no way back.
No,
but that's important to know. So there's about $25, $26 million a year in what others would use to fund
service,
police and fire and those things that we are redirecting into debt service. And others would pay that debt service. And if anyone at home wants to know why I'm waving, there's a horsefly that sits here, and I guess the council has a great ability to collect horsefly, to attract flies. I'd like to believe it's because we're so sweet. But, there's five things we could do. Yeah, we're not gonna go there. I'm sure at home they're coming up with very different explanations as to why we attract flies. But we're doing something that's unique, and you can argue whether that's good or bad, but the fact is that we are redirecting what are normally used by cities around the country, and certainly here in Arizona, for operations, meaning police, fire, courts, those things. We are using those funds to, and have historically, the city has, by policy, by decision, has used those funds to service debt.
That is correct.
Okay.
And getting to slide 11 is that comparison of where we're talking about the combination of secondary and primary rates and how we stack up against the cities. Even if you look at us on a secondary assessed valuation or secondary levy rate against the average, we're well under the average from all comparative cities and well under the average when you look at the total on the combined.
And when you look at the levy, once again, what was Gilbert's... Our assessed valuation was like $139,000. And Gilbert's was like $160,000, $180,000 or more than that.
I'll get the fly if I can ask a question.
Homes, yeah.
So if Gilbert, if we look at that $1.15 secondary,
$185,000.
So that $1.15 has been determined based on $185,000 average assessed valuation secondary.
Right.
Assessed valuation. Our 34 cents is based on 139,000. So when you look at the actual levy, it's significantly less than what other cities are doing.
That's correct.
Okay, Councilmember Higgins.
Just in this, thank you, Mayor. In this comparison chart, we don't include our fund. I'm sorry, the general fund transfers from all our utilities that we were just talking about in the previous session.
No.
So I don't even know how you can show the slide because it's so not fair. Because we're talking property tax. And all these other cities pay use property tax to pay all these other things, general fund, and we do these general fund transfers, yet we compare property tax, so we're not even talking about the same thing.
Well, I would also contend that they transfer from their utilities just like we do.
But that's why we show the homeowner survey, so that included everything.
You know what I'm saying? No, so I hate this chart because I think this is misleading, sharing that.
Well, here's how I would compare that. The stuff that's related to utilities is based on consumption.
Sure.
So we compared all those consumption rates, and they're making transfers out also.
Yeah.
So if I'm taking consumption and basing it then against a fixed site type of cost, I think it's a fair comparison.
That was, but in this case, we're talking primary and secondary property tax, right? Clearly, you're looking at the rates for primary and secondary property taxes from our neighboring cities, and that's what we see on the chart. Mm-hmm. And ours is going to be tiny because the only thing we do with ours is pay off. Well, I guess they do the same thing with their secondary, but primary is totally different.
Well, but then they use their general, the transfers for operating just like we do too.
And I would respectfully take a different view.
Sure.
Is that a nice way to say
you can always.
Because if we were just showing this slide and saying this is the whole picture, that I agree with you. But we haven't. If you look at where we've talked and we've had the whole discussion of how cities finance their operations, we've gone through our rate transfer. We've gone through all this. And so this is just one piece of the picture. And we just had a discussion on the fact that, yeah, we get it that we're using our transfer, utility transfers, basically in lieu of primary property tax. Mm-hmm. That is in essence our in lieu of that. But it still doesn't negate the fact that our structure creates a much lower property tax burden. And when you look at that other slide, which talks about the total
cost
burden, it includes the cost of utilities, and we're still low.
Yes.
So I think if you take it all as a package, it makes perfect sense. But I would agree with you if you just looked at that individually.
Yes.
But we're not.
We're not.
But I think the one figure that's important to know is once again, we got $26 million that we are redirecting out of sales tax, and there's no other city that does that. And to me, that taken into conjunction with this, when you look at our secondary tax and you look at all these other cities and look where that $26 million is embedded in this secondary tax rate, it is not taken out of their sales tax. It's just good to understand why we maybe face some challenges that other cities may not face, or why our situation is different. To me, it's good to get that perspective.
Perfect.
And does that do anything at all, or
sure.
you're still shaking your head?
No, it's all good. Mayor, it's all information.
One interesting factor of this is, as challenging as it has been on the water side with the reductions there of 8% or so each year, but then you think about the reductions in the valuation of our property valuation overall, that's dropped off, and this year we're over 20%.
22.
It's interesting to note that even in the difficult times we're having in water, that's become still a more stable resource than property tax has, at least. And that's a very kind of unusual thing, typically. And so from our financials now, as we kind of talk to bond rating and other financials, we've actually kind of turned that around and said, in some element, it is kind of good to have this kind of two-legged, at least two opportunities, both in the secondary property tax, something that's based on property tax, and something that is also based on utilities, and have those as significant components. Because if you just relied on one or the other, you could see your vulnerabilities either in the water side, could be based, even if your foreclosures were an issue, you could have issues related to weather that could create fluctuations. A property valuations, obviously, economies can make changes there. So actually having a more diverse opportunity where you rely upon your revenues is really where most cities really need to get to. Where we want to try to get to is expanding and broadening the sources that come in to fund local government, so we're not just totally relying on sales tax or totally relying on water. And that property tax does help. It provides a little bit more of a balance, and so you have a little more structure, or I'm sorry, another opportunity for revenues to support your activities.
Councilman Fender.
And could you remind me again on our rating agencies exactly what the city manager is saying, what we went through in the greatest recession, what happened to us?
Well, because we've managed our debt, we've managed our fund balances, we've managed our utilities. We were upgraded on our ratings last year.
And this is the same rating agencies that just put the federal government on a watch list and plummeted the stock market, by the way.
Yeah. The exact same agency.
Okay.
And did the stock market go up when our rating went up? Because I don't know how Wall Street
I'm still
responded.
Waiting on that one.
We'll see. Yeah,
I'm sure it'll be a rush.
You know, one good thing to note is, and sometimes we talk about the transfer as almost being a bad thing, and it's not. I mean, in our city, because we are sales tax driven, there are thousands of properties that have no revenue contact with the city but for utility rates. And that includes all our businesses, small and large, where we provide substantial public safety services to all these big box retailers and all, they don't pay anything to the city of Mesa, except for through the contacts of the utilities. So it's a way to spread that burden and to attach the receipt of services with some revenue that's generated. So I think it accomplishes its purposes. Okay.
Okay, just to give you a comparison, we broke down the individual utilities and their existing utility revenue debt payments and gave you that in total. I don't think this slide's been presented to you this way before. And then the last slide is just comparing all bond debt per resident as compared to those other cities. And graphically, again, it shows that we're in pretty good measure.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
I just have an overall question. I appreciate the presentation. I think it really synthesizes where we are. I was curious in your opening slides talking about the financial policies. Mm-hmm. These were apparently, I guess Mr. Summers may be the only one who knows what they are, because they were adopted 2 weeks before we were sworn in, and they're supposed to be a guide for the council, but I've actually never seen policy. So as a matter of housekeeping, could you send me an email?
And they're actually published in our executive budget book.
But why don't we send them out separately to the
council? Yeah, that way if you can just highlight it so that we can be aware of it in decision making, because I don't remember that in our orientation stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, and that I mean, I know we have a lot of things this is a whole nother discussion. What exactly makes up a policy? I know when the council says this is the policy, that's pretty clear. The question is, if there's a discussion in a meeting and we sort of come to, there's nods here, and then it gets put into a memo or a formal book, that at some point in time we just, is that sort of another way where formalist policies are established, or is that just the sense of the council
these
that
were,
has not these, been changed?
No, these were
these
formally
were actually
adopted.
Formally adopted.
Yeah, they were actually, we were encouraged strongly to have formal written policies by our rating agencies, and because those had not been in place,
Specific thing about the repayment of bonds through general funds is a formally adopted policy.
No, that one is not.
No, that's not in the policy. That's not in. Okay. What we're talking.
No.
No.
All righty. Okay.
It speaks more to the fund balance goals.
Yeah.
It speaks to it. You'll see it.
Those things I understand.
You as you read it, it's not. I don't think it'll be anything of dramatic difference in what we've talked about. And maybe we need to be careful with policy versus practice and direction.
Well, that's what I want.
It's hard. Sometimes we get direction from councils, and then we move in that direction, and that after a period of time it becomes such the practice that we kind of maybe fall and call it a policy. And it's sometimes hard for us, and we can maybe try to use more precise language and what is we consider a policy that's written and a practice and direction. We'll have to work on that.
No, you did a much better job of getting to the point I was making, and it started when Mr. Odom said, we decided, and I go, who's we? Because I think as time goes on, the distinction between policy and practice becomes very blurred, and they tend to mesh
right
together. And I'd just like to know what is formal policy and what is things of practice. Because
that's fair.
In many ways, it may not change a single thing, because I think that overall, we're pretty comfortable that the practices and the policies from a financial management have served us pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some very significant items that we need to, this council needs to revisit, if not this year, then certainly in the years to come. And it's important to know whether that was is just a practice that has just been carried on, or whether there is a formal policy. Because if it's a formal policy, to me that means that there was some real rationale and reasoning and formal analysis of it that went through. I can't be so sure on a practice. We've done a lot of things in this council where we just have a discussion and, yeah, that seems good. Everyone go ahead. And it's not that it's bad. It's just that it's good for the moment. I don't know that I would want that embedded for future generations to say this is the law. Policies, you know, I want to look and see why that was enacted, because there was probably a pretty good reason why the council decided to go to that formal step. Practice, you know, I think we need to take for what it is. It was a good idea at the time, and it may apply, it may not apply. So, thank you. Okay.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Why don't we take about a 5-10 minute break before we get on to the next one? If we could.
I don't know what the schedule of the council. We definitely need to do the items
we will
in the executive
that.
Session. So.
But this one's going to be take a little long. Let's just get 5 minutes.
No, that's fine. We can take that fine.
So let's come back at about a quarter till. Well, you have two options.
Yeah, first one's over.
That's right.
Let's get it over with. That's all I'm saying. So that nobody's happy and everybody's happy.
Yeah, I think.
I'm sad. I'm trying to manage the resources.
Okay, Chief. You got
good morning.
The floor.
Good morning, Mayor. Good morning, Council. We are back here to talk about the convenience store ordinance. Once again, I just want to thank everybody that was involved, our staff, the stakeholders, the Arizona Food Marketing Alliance, and Council for, you know, we really truly want to have an effective crime prevention strategy that is balanced and is focused impact on crime and those particular areas that are of concern. So even though it's taken some time, I think it's well worth it, and I hope that the material that I'm going to go over today is going to be something that you may want to consider. Obviously,
and,
we're here.
Chief, I'd like, before we get going, I'd like to thank you for working a lot diligently with stakeholders. I know you've spent a lot of time with the owners and the association in trying to come up with something that sort of works. And I know that whatever you suggested here, there's been a lot of input, and you've listened to a lot of people, so I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Once again, our goals here, to remind us of why we're even here to do this, is to deter crime through prevention strategies, improve the safety, increase criminal apprehension, improve successful prosecution of criminals, and conserve limited police resources. What we're presenting today are two options of the ordinance. Both options require all convenience stores to have a certification of registration. The reason for this is we have found through our dealings with the businesses that it's often difficult to find somebody who's a responsible party or someone who's a decision maker. This is very similar to the massage ordinance where we're going to require all convenience stores to register. Therefore, we will have somebody that is responsible and that we can contact and someone who's a decision maker. Both options require all convenience stores to have be required for all new and remodeled stores to comply with all security measures. The first option I'm going to discuss is the full compliance option with a variance. This option requires that all convenience stores abide by all security measures listed unless that store can articulate a valid reason to diverge from the required security measures. An example would be the line of sight issue, that maybe the way that their building is designed, that their stock and their shelves may take up part of that front window. They can ask for a variance. That process would be that the crime prevention specialist officers would go out, make the assessment, write up that assessment, and then that would go through the change to the executive officer, which would be me, for a decision of whether that variance would be granted. If a convenience store continues to experience high calls for police service, the chief of police may require additional security measures targeted at that specific criminal act or suspected criminal activity occurring at the store. We discuss this a lot with the stakeholders. They were not fully supportive of the additional security measures. However, when we're discussing, as long as those security measures are specific to a specific crime, then it was more palatable to the industry. Example would be if we're requiring lighting in the rear of the store, it has to articulate, we have to show that there's some kind of crime that's related to having lighting in the back of the store. We just cannot require lighting in the back of the store. So it has to be linked to some specific crime or some specific problem. And that is the additional security measure, which is this clause is in both of the options that we're going to be discussing. Option one with the full compliance and the variance, this is just a list of all the requirements. These really have not changed. I'll read them really quick, but I'm not going to go into each one because we've talked about them. One of the things that we did take off is we had the requirement of beer netting on the displays. Through working with the industry, we did remove that one. Our data showed that we were not, they were not stealing the warm beer. They're stealing the cold beer. However, if we start locking the cold beer, that may be something that in the future we may come back and try to amend. But as of right now, the data did not support that, so we removed that. And I'll just read them real quick. The obtained certificate of registration, the height markers requirement, security signs, the store visibility, employee safety training, our trespass enforcement program, graffiti removal, exterior lighting in the door areas and payphones. Lighting must be operational, requirements that the clerk in the customer area or door locked or alarmed, 8-inch tall address numbers on exterior of the buildings, alarm systems, drop safe, outdoor trash area lighting, beer coolers locked between 2 and 6 a.m., and install of surveillance cameras. Now, this will be all the requirements. Under this option, a business may have the ability to request a variance of any or one or several of these requirements. Option two, we worked really hard with the industry. The industry really supported option two. This really gives a minimal impact on those low service calls for service stores. It has enhanced safety measures on those stores with higher police service calls and criminal activity. This is really trying to find the balance of what we're getting from council and the industry as far as having minimal impact on those stores that are not using with the high calls for service for police or low criminal activity, and really focusing on those stores that are having a lot more issues. The option two is based on the yearly police calls for service and incorporates two levels of enhanced security measures based on those calls for service. This data that we utilize is based on a four-year average. We did not want to look at just last year or 2 years. We used a four-year average to give us some historical data to show if those businesses were having issues.
So that would be a rolling 4 years?
Yes, it would continue. We would be doing an annual assessment on the businesses, but we would use the rolling 4 years.
Okay.
All convenience stores will be required to register. This will be accomplished through the crime prevention officer. The officers will evaluate and certify the stores each year as of needed, and then we would use the four-year data. And these are the baseline numbers that we came up with. If calls for service by the police are between 0 and 29, the convenience store is not required to incorporate any of the security measures, and the police department will continue to provide recommendations, meaning they're not really required to do anything but register. However, we would still work with those stores, make recommendations on crime prevention strategies, and we'll still do assessments, but they're not required by the ordinance. And I got some clarification on numbers. Right, your packet says currently 100 stores would be impacted. That accurate number as of today is 103. And this represents 70% of our stores. So 70% of the stores would not be impacted by requirements of security.
Okay, yeah, because when it says it'll be impacted, actually they will fall under the 0 to 29,
correct.
So therefore they wouldn't have to.
Correct. All they would have to do is register.
They'd be considered low.
They would fall under this.
Under this thing. Gotcha.
Yes. Probably, okay. Probably not the right way.
The next page, all stores with an average of 30 to 69 calls for service per year shall be required to meet the following safety measures. And these are the safety measures, some of the safety measures that I just mentioned. These are more of your minimal, low cost, but enhanced security measures. And currently that would be 25 stores, if we were to use the numbers today, would be impacted, and that represents about 17% of our convenience stores. The next slide, all stores with an average of 70 or more calls for service per year shall be required to meet the safety measures of all the enhanced safety measures that we just discussed. In addition, they would be required to have alarm systems, drop safe, outdoor trash area lighting, beer coolers locked between 2 and 6, and then installment of the surveillance cameras. This is where the industry was saying that's monetarily this has a bit higher impact. Therefore, we're focusing that on those stores that are having troubles.
But at this time, at this point, Chief, at 70 or more calls, you're out there at least once a week, if not more.
Yes. And these are just averages. We have some stores that are even more than that. This would currently impact 19 stores, which represents about 13% of our convenience stores. In addition to the service model, we would also include the additional security measure clause, and also they would include the variance clause. Even under this option, the store would have the ability to request a variance and send that up through if there was some issue that didn't have an impact on their problem. And they, we wanted to throw the variance because we wanted, the industry was really concerned that they didn't have the ability to at least ask for some kind of
process
that shows that we would be looking at. And really our goal is to tie the problems with the crime. So we sit before you today really with the two options. Option number one is the full compliance with the variance, and then option number two is a service use model along with the variance. Something that I wanted to also on the next slide just talk about some initiatives. You know, the use of technology to report crimes, we're trying to streamline that with our online system to make it easier for citizens to make reports and to report crime to police. That is currently in the implementation phase. I had a presentation 2 weeks ago by our staff, and we'll be coming to public safety with that. I think you're really, really going to like it. It looks really, really good. But that would make it easier for our citizens to make those reports. It would obviously limit the resources that we would have to expand on minor crimes and crime thefts. We also are trying to create more awareness in crime areas, and that's where crimereports.com comes in. It's a new program that we presented to public safety where citizens can look at the crime. Convenience stores can look at the crime in the area. They could look at crimes in other area, and they would have an assessment. And also the ability to share current information, crime information, and crime prevention strategies. We can do that with crime reports. Also, utilization of Facebook and Twitter. What I'm trying to get at is we wanted this ordinance, this isn't just where it stops. We have additional strategies to prevent crime, and this ordinance is really just part of that overall strategy.
Okay, my first question, which one does the police department recommend?
Well, here's my political answer.
No, you're not going to get off that easy. You obviously put a lot of work into this, and I know the police department has an opinion. I'd like to know what your recommendation is.
Okay. Option number one is the cleanest and easiest, where everyone has to abide, but we would just make variance appropriate.
For you?
Correct.
Okay.
Option number two is what I would support due to this fact that we worked hard with the industry. That's the one that they support. So I really want to sit before you today and say that you have our support and the industry support.
So the police department would support option number two based on what you just said.
That would be the one that I'm recommending, yes.
Okay. You can state that. That's okay. Councilmember Higgins, then.
Do you see a problem with ordinance based on calls for service? Like, oh, no, we can't get one more call this year. We're going to be in the higher rate, and we've got to do all this extra stuff.
You know, Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, we did discuss that. Anytime you use base calls for service, there's a possibility that they will not report crime. And that's really not what our intention is to, we're not intending them not to just call us. That's why we really went back and used some historical data to give us a true picture of what crime is occurring. If we saw a problem store really just fall off the charts, we would obviously work with them and just, we don't want you just not to call us. We really truly want to prevent crime. So we would watch that and we would work with them and assess what's really going on and try to help them.
Okay, Councilman Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Chief. I appreciate the presentation. I think there's been significant improvement in both options that are presented to us. I still prefer option one, which was the recommendation of our Public Safety Committee. And I do so because, as you noted, it is simple. It's easy to administer. It's easy to understand. Some people may not like it, but it's easy to understand. I think option two does create, sadly, a disincentive to report crimes, and I think it creates some difficulties in administering. I think the rolling four-year average is certainly an improvement on that, but the option one really is the option that offers the best opportunity for a safe environment for the public, for people who work in those stores, and for your officers who respond to those stores. Option one is, I think, the best alternative for both crime prevention and crime apprehension. I think you've had a significant improvement in the issue of the variance where the chief may direct additional security measures. I really do like it to be crime specific, not just saying, I think you need more. I think there needs to be a nexus between the reason for the additional security procedures. And so I think that is an excellent addition to the language in both of the options. I also do think that, again, based on the discussion that we had in our Public Safety Committee meetings, the variance for in option one for stores to have different security measures in working with the department because of a hardship or their design layout, I think that provides the safety valve for stores that would have difficulty complying with this, because I do think that your staff can work with the stores to provide a security measures that provide an equivalency in terms of safety for the employees, the public, and on the officers. So I appreciate the work on both options. I think it's well crafted for both options, but I think the option number one is the preferred way to go if you look at the whole public policy arguments. Thank you.
Okay. Councilman Pinter.
Two quick observations. Really appreciate the crime reports. I had an opportunity to utilize that as a council member. Someone had called and asking about a particular neighborhood looking to move in District 2, able to refer them to the crime reports. They were able to get a lot of good information, saved on staff time, other things. With regard to what you're going to make a presentation to the Public Safety Committee with the online reporting system, key tool to be able to keep our highly trained armed warriors doing warrior work and being able to handle with technology, you know, force multiplying technology the other way. So I sure hope that you run full blast with that. So thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Any other questions, comments?
Yeah, I guess one.
Yeah, Councilman
Higgins. And, you know, when you look at your full compliance and variance list, nothing really seems outrageous. You would think an average store would have these things today, other than maybe, you know, your surveillance cameras, which is always very interesting when you get those KED reports and they say this break-in and no surveillance was available, which is hard because then you can't find that person who might be going to do another crime. So, actually, that sounds like a really good idea. I guess I'm leaning more to the full compliance with, you know, the option one, since we worked on this, 2 years? And it really has come down to what I think is a pretty reasonable list that you guys all worked on pretty well, and I'd say let's I agree with Councilmember Kavanaugh's comments, and that option one seems to be the way to go. Thanks.
Vice Mayor?
Yeah, I got to agree with Councilwoman Higgins on the issue of the cameras. My wife was a victim of identity theft when somebody who had been doing some work at our house stole our credit card and proceeded to use it at a large convenience store chain. And fortunately, it was a large convenience store chain because their security, I'll name it, it was Circle K. And the reason I'm going to name it was because they were very helpful. They had the camera, they had the video, they had security team. They had all the things that are on this list. So, and because of that, they were able to turn the video over to the police department and catch the guy who did it. These things have been proven to be very helpful. So. I like the fact that on that first option that you've added that flexibility of taking out some of the more onerous issues and then adding the flexibility that realizing that there are going to be some circumstances where some stores, just because of their age or location or the building design, what have you, they're just not going to be able to do everything that's on that list. And so the flexibility of being able to appeal that to the chief's office and say, here's our special circumstance of why we can't do that, and then allowing that flexibility to eliminate or tweak something should be extremely helpful. So I would support that as well.
I also appreciate the work that's been done. I appreciate the work that the Public Safety Committee did, but I think this is part of the process. I support option two for a couple reasons. Number one, it's the result of a process that started with the committee that did a good job of identifying the issue. But it also brought in other issues that the police department addressed in subsequent follow-up with the industry, with the businesses themselves. And we have always used deference in this council to stakeholder input. And I'm reluctant to go against an agreement that the police department and the stakeholders now have agreed to that says this solves the problem. This balances the requirements. And I applaud you for taking the time and effort to do that, and that's option two. And to go with option one sort of flies in the face of what we say all the time. Have you talked to stakeholders? Have you gotten their input? And what we're saying is that we are going to now ignore that. The second thing is I think the variance thing in option one is really, it mystifies me. Because in a sense, what is the hardship? Are we saying that if somebody has a high crime incidence but they can't afford something, that we're not going to require that? I mean, that's sort of an absurd situation that actually could come up. If somebody does not have a hardship or does not have a high crime, but they have a hardship, they're going to fall into the exclusion under option two anyway. And so it seems that financial hardship from a crime-fighting standpoint doesn't make sense, because you know we can spend all the money in the world, have cameras everywhere, and that'll fight crime, but we always seek a balance, and the variance doesn't seem to take that really into consideration, because I don't know what the variance is based on, and it seems ridiculous that you give somebody a variance because of financial hardship. That's not the issue we're trying to get here. We're trying to fight crime and to create situations that balance the impact on those businesses that are operating in ways that we haven't determined that's right, but they have. They've decided what they can do to create a secure situation. And they've succeeded, and we know they've succeeded because of the lack of police calls. I understand the concern about people being unwilling to call police. I really don't buy that much, because number one, you've mitigated that by going to a four-year average, which means it really have to be a concerted effort by an owner over a long period of time to avoid police calls. I just don't see that that's number one, human nature, and that number two, that is in standing with good business practices and other requirements that businesses have, such as insurance company requirements, corporate requirements, those other things. I really don't think that that's going to play out, because I think that life happens and people are going to report. And even if they do hold off on a couple calls here and there, there's no one call that will make or break them because you are using a four-year average. So for those reasons, I applaud you for working diligently with the stakeholders in considering the fact that this is the police department's recommendation, this is the stakeholders' recommendation, how we have operated in the past in deferring in those situations to staff when they have worked with stakeholders to come up with a solution that seems to work. I would support option two. And I think that's sort of the end of a process that started, once again, with the good work that the Public Safety Committee did, and it's evolved, and that's how it should work. And it shouldn't be easy to make laws that impact people in a significant manner. And this is a good example of things that we've been patient with, and you've worked hard and diligently. I know that, so thank you very much. So we have both options. We need to give some direction. We have some that have stated they support option one. We have others that say they support option two. Do I have a motion on either one or the other? Councilmember Higgins.
I move, Mayor, that we move ahead with option one.
Okay. We have a motion from Councilmember Higgins that we move together ahead with option one. A second from Councilmember Kavanaugh. Councilmember Fenter.
I came in very neutral on this, watching the whole thing over a long period of time. I'm going to base my decision not to support this motion on Chief Mays's recommendation. So, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Councilman Kavanaugh.
And just a comment in response to your statement. I don't think we should mischaracterize the process for option one, which has changed in significant ways since the Public Safety Committee discussed it as a result of the council discussion. So that has not been a static measure. So the option one we have today is different from the option one that was presented to council several months ago. And again, I think that those changes were made in response to discussions and work with the stakeholders. So both options really have been developed with input from the stakeholders, and I think we need to keep that in mind. Thank you.
And I didn't want to infer that it was not, but I believe that both the police department and the stakeholders would recommend option two as the preferred option. So make that. Okay, we have a motion to... and a second on selecting option one. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed nay.
Nay.
Councilmember Glover, how did you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries 4-3 with council members Richens, Fenter, and the mayor voting no. Option one is adopted. Okay.
Well, no. That's what we're taking.
Option one is directed, not adopted. I'm sorry. The direction is, thank you. Option one is chosen as the preferred option. So
it'll come forward for introduction, probably on the 16th.
Yeah, okay. All right. Okay, next issue is to hear a report, presentation, discuss, provide direction, adoption of the energy code.
Yes. I thought we were going to conferences attended.
Unless you went to an energy code conference, no.
No, somebody invited me, and I'm like, oh.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Christine Zalanka with the Development and Sustainability Department, and I have Laura Heineman here today, and we have a very brief presentation on a proposed energy code, and we'll be looking for direction as to whether or not Council would like us to move forward with adoption of an energy code and also which version. Just to give you a little bit of background, this is one of the projects, evaluation of an energy code, that we actually funded with our Energy Efficiency Conservation Block Grant stimulus project that our department has been overseeing. We came to Council approximately a year ago with that priority list, just shared the projects that we were doing. Laura has spent a significant amount of time over the past year working with stakeholders, evaluating the various codes. So she's going to give us a quick presentation today, and again, we'll be looking for direction. Thank you. Laura?
Thank you. The International Energy Conservation Code is actually one of the family of building codes. It is referred to as the Energy Code. It is developed through a consensus process with representatives of the public sector, advocates, and building industry working together every 3 years to update and put together measures that they all agree make sense. the energy code really applies to energy efficiency of buildings only. It applies to new construction, and the approach for existing buildings, I think, is very reasonable. It does apply to only components that are replaced within an existing building, so that if you replace a mechanical unit, it asks that that mechanical unit is energy efficient and meets certain SEER standards. It does not require you to add insulation that may not exist or upgrade windows. It's simply with existing buildings, it addresses the only things that you are changing. And then when you take a look at how the energy code is applied to buildings.
Laura?
Yes.
I'm curious.
Sure.
Yeah, close enough. can I purchase on the market items that don't meet the energy standard?
Yes, there are products that are out there that do not meet the energy efficiency requirements. I think we've had the question asked and reversed quite a bit. What is the availability of products that do comply with the energy code? Are they affordable? Are they reasonable? And because more and more people have made energy efficiency a priority, the windows that meet the code, the mechanical equipment that meet the code are available and affordable. But you can also still purchase windows that do not meet the code and that are not compliant, if I understood your question correctly.
Yeah, I added on to my house not too, a few years ago, but not that long ago, and it seemed to me that single-pane windows hardly even exist anymore. It seems people are really focused on energy efficiency, and it's even at the lower levels, I would think, the mm-hmm. the entry level, I should mm-hmm. say. Mm-hmm. It's Energy Star or SEER, depending on what you're purchasing. So I was just curious as to, as we write this code, how much that's an issue with non-compliant mechanicals even being available or windows.
It is interesting because as the rebates have been offered, they've found that those units that do not comply to get the rebates have suddenly really dropped in price because they're having a hard time selling them. But I think as builders and homeowners look, what makes sense over the long term, and the energy code is really something that you look at for your return on investment over a number of years. So you may save some money on that non-compliant mechanical system, but if you take a look at the long term, you'll get the savings back, and you need to continually make that assessment. And we're finding that builders are. But you're right, the non-compliant materials are getting less and less available.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of your decision making is made by what I have in my wallet today, not so much as will I get this money back, right, unless I have the extra cash. But all right. Thank you. That's good.
I was going to talk a little bit about the components that are covered by the energy code. The building envelope, which is that kind of barrier between the conditioned or the inside space and the outside space, your walls, your windows, your roof. It also covers the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning equipment, so your mechanical equipment is covered, the efficiency of that. Service water heating in commercial development, so water heaters, and then lighting. There are a couple compliance options for builders and designers. They can select to use a simple set of prescriptive measures. For instance, do the R values of a wall assembly meet a certain standard? The other option is to use computer modeling. It's based on the Department of Energy software. It's in the public domain, and somebody can do something that's a little different or not strictly complying with those measures and create an energy model that shows what the initial cost is and what the energy savings is. As long as that model shows that you meet the standards of the energy code, your project is approved through the according to the energy code. And I've really covered this very, very quickly. We have more information on our website if you're interested in looking a little bit deeper into some of these issues. So we come to you with the question of whether it should be 6 or 9. As Christine mentioned, the subcommittee recommended the adoption of the 09 code. We have met with the developers advisory 4 separate times, and a majority of the stakeholders that we met with were also looking at 6 as something that they are building to and they're comfortable with. If you adopt the 2006 code, it does establish a minimum baseline for energy efficiency in all construction. It's commonly used throughout the valley, and the products are readily available. It would fit in seamlessly with our adopted building codes. No amendments. It is designed to fit in, and it works nicely. There would be no changes to the codes. If you were to recommend adoption of the 2009 code, it is a little bit more stringent. The performance of buildings built to that would be, there would be an energy savings for users of those buildings. It is, the 2009 code is similar to what SRP PowerWise is right now and Energy Star version 3. So people are becoming more familiar with that, and it's equivalent to the 2009. If we were to adopt this, we'd also say if a builder or a homeowner or a business owner is building something to Energy Star or SRP PowerWise, it complies, and there would be no need for them to demonstrate anything else to us. We would require some minor changes to the to the MESA codes. One thing that's changed is you make a building envelope tighter, you need to be concerned about fresh air and ventilation. So the calculations for that have changed slightly. When I talked to Steve Heather, our building official, a lot of people are wanting to request that change to ventilation standards anyway, so we would want to make sure we made that part of this code adoption so people had that option to use this different way of calculating ventilation. We really were...
Excuse me, Laura. Thanks. Is that calculation in the 2009 code already?
Yes.
Okay, so if we did the 2009, we wouldn't have to change?
No.
Great.
No.
Thanks.
And even if we move forward with the 6, we would like to bring forward as an amendment to this council, allowing people to use that option of that ventilation. It's really a reasonable amendment. We were concerned to go to Councilman Summers' comment about cost and how this works with a homeowner that's making an investment. So the Department of Energy issued a technical assistance grant, and we went to the Pacific Northwest National Labs and said, do an assessment of both residential and commercial buildings in the city of Mesa. What's the cost to build to the 2003? I selected that because we have no code. The 2006 or the 2009. So they did a detailed report, and that's also available online. But in summary, this table shows that to build to the 2006 code, it costs approximately $800. The report shows how that's built in a mortgage spread over 30 years and what the impact on the pocketbook is. Then to build to the 2009 code, they figured that it was about $1,256 additional cost to build that home to the 2009 energy code standards. They then took a look at, well, what are the heating and cooling costs annually on those three different types of homes? And as you can see, the energy cost does drop down. The savings per year, they figured with the 2006 code was about 5%, and the 2009 code was about 15%. So when you figure that over the number of years, you can see how there is quite a return on your initial investment.
I guess I'm surprised that the savings aren't greater. Is that because we've already reached a certain level with just the standard market-driven things like, you know, Vice Mayor talks about how, you know, it's tough to buy single-pane windows now. Most basically double-pane are the standard.
Correct.
You know, I don't know. I know when I was started in the business, we were building with 8 SEER air conditioning units, and by the time I left, we were up to, I think, 11 or 12 as a standard. I don't know where they are now. That 13 or
14 is pretty
14.
Standard.
Mm-hmm. And so it just seems like, and those were the standards, not the add-ons. So it seems like just by the market we're moving up and people are demanding more. So is that what you're seeing? Is that why the increases really are incremental? There's not some gigantic step.
Correct.
Okay.
I think you're right. The products out there are really improving and more available. People are using them. The change that happens in the 9 code versus the 6 and the previous codes is really inspecting for the building envelope. Has it been sealed properly? Because in the past, you know, we've said, yes, you need to seal it, but there has been no inspection or testing done. So the 2009 code is
Does
now...
Does the 9 code get into, like, air conditioning ducts and things like that?
Yes.
As far as inspecting those and standards for those, as far as leakage?
Yes.
Okay.
Because they're finding there's quite a bit of savings if you make sure that that's been properly insulated and sealed. Now, the 2009 code offers an inspection option and a testing option, and we fully support this allowance of people to use either method of demonstrating compliance. The test will be more accurate but we also want people to be able to do the inspection process if that makes sense to them. We also asked the Pacific Northwest National Labs to take a look at commercial projects, four different prototypes, and this was a little bit more complicated for them, but they did the best. We sent in projects that were typically constructed and construction methods that are used in Mesa, Arizona, and they came up with a table that shows the dollars per square foot cost for energy, and as you can see with each of the codes, it drops down quite a bit because they keep improving those standards, the material that's included in a building. We really didn't want to do this without spending some time talking to the people that are building and developing in our community. So we've been to the Developers Advisory four separate times, and we've talked to them very specifically about the code, what's in the code, how does it work, what do you see the challenges are. The 2009 Energy Code is available for free download, so you can anybody can go out there and take a look and read through it, and a lot of our stakeholders actually have, to find out, well, what exactly is this code and what's it going to require. And so we had some dialogue, and through that process we will bring forward some suggested amendments that make sense to them. I met with 75 or more stakeholders that covered commercial, residential, homeowners, business owners, property managers, just really wanted to talk to everybody about this code. We met with the Home Builders Association of Central Arizona. They pulled together a number of home builders. We went out to their offices and met with them and talked with them about how are they incorporating this in the product that they're building today. And then also we've been working with the utilities in the State Energy Office.
On that note, I remember the first time that we were going to hear this, and this presentation has been put off a couple of times, we had a letter here from SRP. Can you talk to us a little bit about what SRP's feeling was on this energy code, what that letter said, basically?
Sure. SRP is very supportive of adoption of this energy code. In fact, they are really becoming advocates of the energy code.
Which one?
The 2009. Okay. The 2009 is very consistent with their SRP PowerWise Homes program and their PowerWise business.
That's an optional program, though.
It's optional, and it offers rebates.
And builders use that as a premium option for home buyers who want to opt into that, correct?
Yes.
It's a marketing benefit to them. If we do the 2009, what's the next marketing benefit? Have we sort of hit the ceiling? Have we sort of reached the pinnacle as far as what's out there? Or?
Well, as things in the energy efficiency business and the home building business, they're constantly striving to what makes a better product. The 2012 codes have been adopted and approved. Energy Star is really forging ahead, looking at this, how can you build structures to be more energy efficient? So they're starting to set the next
goal.
So
what you're saying is the market is basically, we're not having to push the market toward this. The market is taking care of this without us.
And they're starting to move beyond.
So if that's the case, why would we want to, if the market's taking care of this, why would we want to go to the max if what we're saying is already being taken care of in the market?
I would like to respond to that.
No, it's a rhetorical question. I'd like to know. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I think one of the reasons is people who build buildings and owner occupy them. This makes perfect sense because they are going to occupy and operate a building for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. They can get the return on the investment very quickly. One of the things I noted interesting in this presentation is the cost savings for, say, multifamily apartments, where you have the energy costs, basically the majority of the energy costs in that building are passed on to the residents. And so the builder of that building really has no real financial incentive to build it to any energy standard other than using the standard materials in the marketplace. So that's where I think we have a public policy discussion about, do you nudge somebody who doesn't have a financial interest in building with energy efficiency towards building with energy efficiency in order to protect the greater energy grid and reducing energy consumption, particularly in our service area, in Mesa's electric utility service area? You know, there's an advantage to us to lower utility.
Is that nudge the 06 code, or is there a nudge and a push?
It depends if we want to be with the PAC and the 2006 code, or if we want to show regional leadership, which this council has said in the past it does, and adopt the 2009 code. You already had Laura mention that they've adopted the 2012 code. So, you know, we act on the 2006 code, which is, I think, the easy way. You know, you're already 6 years behind. You know, but like you say, the market is leading this. And, you know, probably within a year, the 2009 standard
was going to be
is
the standard.
It's there already, you know. And so I think we show some regional leadership. We become the first city in the East Valley to adopt the 2009 code. We're there. Everybody's heading there anyway. The market's heading there, you know. But then we nudge those who don't have that big financial interest in building with energy efficiency into doing so. That's the public policy decision before us.
I think this next slide really goes to some of the things that Dave was mentioning. When we were talking to stakeholders, they kind of fell into two camps. One of those was that the most businesses are out there and they're doing energy efficiency on their own. They're building it into their capital improvement programs because they are owners of the property and they do get that return on investment back in their own pocketbook. Builders and developers are finding that it makes their products more marketable. If, you know, it's very competitive out there right now, but if you can show that you have an accepted symbol showing that you do comply with a specific code and you're not just saying I'm green or I'm energy efficient, if you can demonstrate that you're meeting very specific standards, they're finding that they're able to move their product along. Most people I talk to are taking advantage of those rebates from the utilities, you know, when they can, when it makes sense for them.
What's the opposition primarily to the 09 code? Just because it's different and they will have to come up with some adjustments to their plans if they're building across city lines?
It was very interesting because when I first came out with the 2009, many people were very skeptical about what it was. But I have been meeting with them now for more than a year to figure out what the challenges are and how can we address those things. And people are feeling more and more comfortable about it. The question of windows came up initially. Well, it turns out now that the 2009 compliant windows are available. And because even though they may be vinyl, they've been so much improved over the vinyl windows that were out 10 years ago, there's not a problem, and they're now affordable.
Now explain why there was a problem with the vinyl windows in Arizona.
Yes, in our climate, the chemical composition did not hold up, and so
that could create a problem.
That could create a problem, yeah. But some of our home builders that are building in this community are now advocates for the vinyl windows. In fact, William Lyons Homes, he went on for quite some time telling me that they're just not a problem anymore. They work, they hold up in our climate, they've changed the way they're designed. And they're also affordable. They're an energy, they're compliant with the 2009. So you asked why
people... And just so everyone knows, vinyl as opposed to most of our windows are aluminum and wood, but mainly aluminum.
And the aluminum and the the wood windows, it's easy to comply, and the aluminum windows, as long as they're thermally broken.
Obviously, aluminum is much more readily conducts heat than vinyl does.
Right. So if they're thermally broken and they're designed to be efficient, you can still use the aluminum windows. And the other thing that's, as long as we're talking about windows, we all understand the intensity of our heat, but that solar heat gain coefficient, that low E film protection is constantly being, in 2009, they've made that a little bit stricter, and that's a great savings in our climate. That's something that's very appropriate. And I didn't talk about how the country is divided into seven different climate zones, and this applies to our state, and I know I could go on very long.
Now, if we adopt this, do we have a way people can go to the chief and get a variance so they can opt out of this? Oh, wait, I'm sorry, last conversation. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and I will speak to the fact that we do have the code modification process, and if somebody brings through a project that is approaching this a little differently, they can use the modeling software, or they can talk with us about things they're doing a little differently. So we do have some opposition, but honestly, it's been changing. I've noticed over the last year there's been a shift. I'll talk about implementation in a little bit. I just wanted to touch base on the regional standards, and again, and since I put this slide together a couple months ago, we now have Tempe and Chandler that are considering this code and looking at adoption of the 2009 energy code, in addition to the one shown on this slide.
So if we take a look at implementation and compare the 2006 to the 2009, the 2006, both codes will require one additional inspection to go out in the field, make sure that insulation has been installed. Our inspectors are not out in the field at that point in the process right now. Talk to the building inspectors to figure out how we can work that into the inspection schedule, and we think we can manage that without too much of an impact. But we'll...
How many projects do we really have going on here that that would be impact? I mean, if we're going to change a code on something, I guess what I'm saying is, isn't this a good time during the breeding period?
That it there is an SRP information that SRP submitted, and it's one of the exhibits in your packet. I'd be happy to post it online. But it's interesting because they show the number of homes that have been built over the last 4 years, and the number that were built versus those that were SRP power-wise homes that were looking at energy efficiency, and the number of homes has dropped, but the number of SRP power-wise homes has risen or stayed the same. So those that are building are really using that.
Yeah, once again, that's the market responding and trying to get an edge on that.
Good news for us is that those that are not building right now, they are becoming aware of these standards. And
I guess that's what I'm saying. I mean, we're in this pause. They're designing for the next... hopefully for the recovery. If we're going to change, it would seem like now's the time to do it so they can incorporate those in the plans that come up, because we're right on the cusp of maybe having a little bit more building coming up. Well, yeah, Councilmember Higgins?
With that in mind, is the 2012 code out that people are adopting?
They have this consensus meeting and the whole group gets together, and so they've officially approved the 2012 code. I understand
they mean
the International Code Council, okay, the ones that approve all building codes and publish them.
And should we be looking at that, since the mayor has an excellent point?
It'll be published in fall of 2011.
Okay.
And I think when the city currently has the 2006 codes in place, and we will be as a city looking at those 2012 codes, we'd probably like to do that all together. So this is, I guess we're coming to you at this point in time saying, think about these two now so that when in a year we think about the next version of codes, and we can look at it across the board and how it affects.
And these are just the energy section part of
the
code. We're not changing the other broad type based code. Okay.
We're just looking at the energy code. With regard to implementation, we're thinking that 6 months. Anybody that does have a project in design and is putting together the business plan for developing that property, we should give them some time to make this adjustment to either the 2006 or 2009 code. Perhaps with the 2009 code, you may want to allow a little extra time for people to become more familiar with that 2009 code. And any projects that have been submitted and are already in our system, we'd like to let them be grandfathered at that 2006. With the codes that they've been designed for right now. They wouldn't need to make changes. If you have some plans in the system, you would be grandfathered. No changes required.
Just quickly, could you run by that sentence again?
Sure.
I missed the first part of that.
We have the other group of people who do have projects that are already in our system, or they may have a template for one model home for an entire subdivision that they're building. We are recommending that those be grandfathered in. So that
wouldn't those by default, though? I mean, if the market, I look at all those cities, and I know that people don't do different plans for different cities. So just by default, aren't they already being built at 06 standards?
Most are.
Yeah, okay.
Unless they're really getting that
so,
Energy Star.
So even if we're grandfathering, we're not grandfathering to a non-standard. We're really grandfathering, and what's being built out there really is probably being built those 06 standards. Maybe our inspection and that type of process isn't implemented, but we're getting something even without doing anything.
Yes.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins.
Is there any way that we can do a modification of what the mayor just said? Because we, for example, this would add an inspection when the insulation goes in, right, before it gets covered up. Mm-hmm. And we've had these energy audit people show us where, you know, there's the whole troughs of sections of houses where you don't see the batting isn't there because, you know, they drywall beforehand. So even though you might not be doing other upgrades to the 2009, could we still, like, do a cross-section of those new houses that would include the inspection? Because,
right.
I mean, we're looking to make sure that people are getting good value for money from a policy statement too, those neighborhoods that have a better energy efficiency, I think, are going to be more sustainable because your bills are lower. They're going to likelihood of being able to stay in your house. If prices go out through the roof are higher because you're spending less money. So that's where I'm going.
We're actually recommending that we implement a sort of a pilot program over the next year to look at what the actual cost of inspections are. Okay. I'm not sure that it actually takes an inspector another whole trip to go out there. If they're in a subdivision, it would be relatively inexpensive for them to go buy homes that are under construction. So we'll be evaluating that relative to the inspection piece of it.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. I'm sorry, Dave.
Is that in honor of Jack Friedline that we're going to do a pilot program?
Yes, that will be the Jack Friedline inspection pilot.
The Jack Friedline Memorial Pilot Program. And
one other thing with that. And Southwest Gas, I'm sure, talked to you about their support for the 2009 code, too.
Yes.
All right. I just want to put that out there also.
And so what direction specifically are you looking for? Because we don't have a code now. Are you looking for, number one, the question as to whether we should implement a code? And then is there a secondary question as to which code that we should shoot toward?
Yes,
that's exactly right.
So it's I guess if you do the second one, you sort of answered the first one, though, haven't you?
Correct.
Yes.
So which code would you like us to move forward with, the 2006 or the 2009?
Okay.
I'd move to go ahead and show some regional leadership on this one and implement the 2009 code. So, yes, we should implement a code and 2009, because that's, we're going to be, the standard is going to lag if we go with 2006 anyway.
I agree with Councilmember Richens, 100%, since that came out of our committee last year at that rate. So.
Okay.
I second the non-motion motion.
We'll say that's a motion. So we have a motion on the table to move forward in adopting the 2009 code. Motion by Councilmember Richens, second by Councilmember Higgins. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Excellent.
Thank you. Your direction.
We will bring it back shortly.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Meetings or conferences attended? Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just reminding Council, Saturday, this Saturday, May 7th, invite everyone to come out and shop for their mothers at the Fiesta Mall and join us at City Hall at the Mall from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And we'll next study session will be May 12th.
Great.
Thank you.
Ms. Parker, do we have any requests to speak from the public?
Request, Mayor.
Entertain a motion to enter into executive session, having the Vice Mayor, second Councilmember Glover. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We'll now move into executive session. Thank you very much.